Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Divya Victor here in the studio with her book on the table, Curb. And we'll also be talking a little bit about the upcoming book out with Grey Wolf in 2027, is it, Divya?
Yes.
Yeah. And that will be a book of essays. And so we'll get to hear a little bit of that too. Welcome. How is it being in Ann Arbor, your first moments? Because did you just arrive today?
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, T. I loved our walk from the hotel to the radio station in the snow and this bright light. Michigan light is so special.
Well, we should say you've come all the way from Michigan State.
That's right.
Hello, Spartans out there, as well as Go Blue.
Indeed. And, you know, there is a cultural difference between our campuses, isn't there? And I enjoy it. It does feel like I'm in a different place in all kinds of ways. Yeah.
Well, so glad you're here. And you're here in town as a Zelle visiting writer as part of the series. And you'll be reading tomorrow at UMA at the University of Michigan Museum of Art in the Stern Auditorium. As you know, I'm letting everyone else know out there too, 5:30 start time. And there'll also be a Q&A, I think, afterwards too. So that should be fun.
Oh, yes. I'm really looking forward to it. I learned so much about my own work in the Q&A, and it prepares me for the work that's ahead. So I'm very much looking forward to it.
Oh, brilliant. And then the next day you have the craft lecture, and that's called Black and Bramble.
Yes.
What will that do? Can you give us a quick...
I will give you a sneak preview about the craft talk. It is, on one hand, it's a talk about blackberries. And it's also a talk about how we inherit a kind of vocabulary within the what we call the Western poetic tradition and the responsibilities of an inheritance that is for some of us, like writers of color, writers who come from post-colonial contexts, is a very complicated inheritance. And we reserve the right to reject some of that inheritance. And I'm tracking how the word blackberry travels through history within the Western canon after the war, after the Second World War, into the present.
How did you decide on that particular time period, Divya?
It has something to do with my education and the work I was reading, you know, starting with the Romantics and then, you know, the Victorian writers, but really where I arrive into my own understanding of who I am as a poet and who I want to consider my people and my kith, that is it's an alertness that happens for me after the war, right? Like it's post-war and contemporary writing where I really become alert to the possibility that folks like me can be poets in the English language.
I remember once, I mentioned earlier to you that I came here for the MFA program, so quite many moons ago now, and I remember Lorna Goodison. I was lucky to be in one of her workshops, saying how, because Lorna has also been the Poet Laureate of Jamaica, and saying that her public readings and sort of her schooling when she was growing up was definitely seemed to be rooted in the soil of the Lake District in England and the flowers, the flora, the fauna. And she's like, you know, at a certain point, well, that's something, but that's not this. This isn't Harvey River. This isn't, you know.
That's right. And we'll definitely be hearing about the Lake District on Friday and what grows there in the bramble and what certainly didn't grow in the soil of my native places and what else was growing.
Which are Singapore and India.
And India, yeah. So really thinking about how certain poetic traditions can oust the flora of someone's native understanding of place, like blackberries do.
Yes.
Because they're a ruderal species. They will grow almost anywhere, and they're so invasive.
And it was quite sweet. I think I saw you with blackberries at the front desk of the hotel. Yes. So that will be always a memory.
Yes, but I really hope that fruit can always be part of my presentations in public. But yeah, for sure you get blackberries if you come on Friday.
On Friday. And that's 10 a.m. at the Robert Hayden Room, third floor of Angel Hall, everyone. Before we go any further, what I'll do is I'll read our time-honored tradition of your bio. Divya Victor is a Tamil-American poet, essayist, and educator. She is the author of Curb, which won the 2022 Pen America Open Book Award and the 2022 Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. Divya is also the author of Kith. Oh, could you help me with a German one? I meant to actually ask you before.
We can skip over that one.
I'd love to hear you say it, though. Do you want to say? You want to,
it's a Schenglichkeit.
Thank you. Okay. Because these, and it's three essays then.
In translation. Wonderful translator, Lena Schmidt.
Lovely. Okay. And then the next book, Natural Subjects, Unsub, and Things to Do with Your Mouth. What a great title. I think that's the first title of yours that I ever heard floating around in the world. And I thought, wow.
I'm very interested in the mouth. For all kinds of reasons. Sight of appetite, sight of love, sight of speech.
Yes. Oh, and well, it's interesting. In Curb, the arc, we end with parts of the body mm-hmm. as well, but not the mouth.
No.
I think we have... is it the ankle?
Mm-hmm.
We'll go there. Let me see. I hope I'm not everywhere today, folks, but bear with me. Back to the bio. She was a 2023 Pan-affiliated fellow at Civitella Rainier and a collaborator on an Andrew Mellon Just Futures grant. She's been a Mark Diamond Research Fellow at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, a River Run Fellow at the Archive for New Poetry at University of California, San Diego, and a writer-in-residence at the Los Angeles Contemporary Exhibition. Her work has been performed or installed at the Museum of Contemporary Art, MoCA, Los Angeles, National Gallery, Singapore, the Los Angeles Contemporary Exhibition, and Museum of Modern Art, MoMA. I don't know why I'm reading the acronyms. It is the second week of school, so you are going to get like some sort of gold medal for bearing with me today. Thank you. I'm so glad it's you. And I also want to reach out and say apologize to you because I've been looking so forward to talking with you. So I hope it's still, I hope you have some fun today on
I'm
the radio.
And I'm glad it's me too. I mean, it would be terrible not to be me right now.
Oh, right.
I would be really suffering my own disembodiment.
Well, and that happens sometimes, doesn't it?
Yes.
I don't know. It's been that kind of week, though. Mm-hmm. It's not as far away as one should keep it. To the bio. She has been an editor at Jacket 2 and for Ethos Books, Invisible Publishing, and Book Hug Press, which I love because all of these endeavors are international, one in the U.S., but the other is international. Her work has been translated into French, German, as we heard, Spanish, Polish, and Czech. She's currently an associate professor of English and writing at Michigan State University, where she is the director of the Creative Writing Program. Divya, have you been growing that program since you arrived? Because I listened to a podcast of you and one of the MSU deans, and now I feel like it was some time ago, mm-hmm. because in it, you were talking about community mm-hmm. and wanting more of a creative community mm-hmm. to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clear to me from listening to this episode how you were already, like, your presence was so valued, and it seemed to be something, like, you might be a cornerstone for a vision, for building, for MSU.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so this is a weird question to start with, but how do you feel? Because when we were walking over here, you also did say, like, about teaching, like, how, like, the sparks that are there, and even with the Q&A that's coming up tomorrow, mm-hmm. having insights into your work from the community that's gathered. I don't know. What's it like?
You're using an architectural metaphor, right, to imagine building something, becoming a cornerstone. And I think that really resonates with me, T, because what I'm taken back to is, you know, being in my 20s in Buffalo, and there was a poet there, my peer and a friend, Michael Cross, and he said to me, if you go to a place and something, you find you need something and it's not there, have you considered that you could be the one who builds it? And I really took that to heart. I'm an only child, so I have this this kind of, you know, adaptation within me that responds to an absence in a place. And I say, I was always authorized to sort of go in and say, what can I do? I roll up my sleeves and I say, what can I do? And a beautiful thing about MSU is that they like me with my sleeves rolled up, enthusiastically sort of going in and saying, I think we have a real opportunity here to reach young writers and older writers who are coming in as students in an absolutely new way, in ways that their parents never recognized them for, their community never recognized them for. So many of our students are queer or first generation or children of immigrants who have never been told that they are welcome to become writers, who've always seen writing as such a big risk. And I have been building, I think, a place where all of us feel welcome to be writers and to know what that is for us. Yes, it's been a delight to be there for 7 years and build a writer's studio, build an annual reading series called the Living Breathing Writing Series.
Oh, so yours is also living and breathing, like living writers here today. Yeah,
absolutely.
We are here.
We are here. We're insisting on living with our writing and, writing through our living.
Yes. Oh, that's wonderful. And what is, and the writer's studio, what is that like?
You know, a couple of years ago, a student came into class and we were doing some sort of somatic work in the classroom. And I said, so let's, you know, work with our bodies here. And she said, I'm just not going to be able to sit down and, you know, stand up very quickly because my back is hurting. I was like, you're 19. What's going on? And she said, I've been writing in my bed all week. And I said, why have you been doing that? And so we had this conversation about the body's participation in making meaning. And I realized my students are writing in cafes and, you know, it's like that's a $20 like writing hour, you know, or they're writing in libraries where they have no privacy. Mm. And the absence of privacy, the absence of quiet, and most crucially, the absence of beauty in their surroundings, it like pierced me. And I said, well, you have the right to a quiet and beautiful environment in which you can be a writer. So we have in fact built and opened a writing studio with, you know, computers and plush couches, and it looks like a jewel box that you open at night. That's how I imagined it. And now you can just go there and read between classes and write.
And it's for the students. It's for the students in the creative writing program, or for any student.
Any College of Arts and Letters student can come in, read the books in the library that we have there, they can eat the snacks, they can make themselves a cup of tea, and they can work on a draft, and they can meet writers who are in the same place as they are in their life.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear it, and I love imagining it, and this idea of, because it feels like a place where, not that you have to have something that has to be just this way so that you can write. Like, I know sometimes we can as writers put obstacles, like it mm-hmm. has to be this or my lucky pen. I don't know if it's that, but it seems like space matters, and a space that feels valued for being the community that it is. So you feel that it's valued and the care for it already. And that energy is different in that space.
Yes,
and you can be part of it.
It's a validation of what they want to do, ultimately.
Yeah. Yes.
I didn't have a desk until I was 11. So I wrote on my mom's sewing table and our dining table sometimes, and on the doors that led to, you know, the terrace of our one-bedroom flat. And I've written everywhere.
Would you lean on the door?
I would lean on the door and write with chalk. Yes. And then we also had a terrace made of terracotta tile. And this was in Trichy, India, and I would write on the terracotta, which then would wash away with the rain. And I think you can write almost anywhere, and you should be able to write almost anywhere. But the body has needs. And I think there is a balance between being kind of intellectually flexible and capable of shifting with your environment and having an environment that's, you know, a physical environment that supports your body from not hurting. Yeah.
Yes, 1,000,000%. Today on Living Writers, Divya Victor is here. Her book on the table with us is Curb. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. You're just in time. Today in studio, Divya Victor is here. Her book, Curb, is on the table with us, out with Night Boat Press. Divya will be reading tomorrow at UMA at 5:30 in the Stern Auditorium, and also in person. And also, I think you can Zoom in if you want. There's a link you can sign up for online, too. So both ways, you could go on Friday at 10 a.m., to hear Divya's craft talk, Black and Bramble, the craft lecture, Friday, 10 o'clock. Okay. So could you tell us a little bit about the music? Thanks for choosing the music for today.
I'm so delighted that, you know, you have all been listening to some of the songs that I picked. I think we just listened to Say She She, which is, they just dropped a new album called Prism. And I really love that they are moved through like psychedelic rock, but also disco at the same time. They have a real tonal range, and it's, you know, it's an all-woman band that's really unafraid of exploring like the mopiest, most melancholic range of feelings in the most danceable form. So my daughter and I love to dance to some of their music. We also listen to Vijay Iyer's cover of MIA, I believe. So quite apart from MIA's current politics, I have to say I love Vijay Iyer's music. I love every single one of his collaborations. His most recent one with Aruj Aftab, of course, is a personal favorite.
Yeah. I love to think of you and your daughter dancing and in throughout Curb, because your daughter has a presence in Curb as like a when you're pregnant, I believe, and then your mother is also very present throughout Curb. Your father is mentioned, and you say, and you didn't call him. Mm-hmm. I thought that was great. And I think I can understand why now from reading the poem, maybe. But
yeah.
It feels like the family is so very central, place and family, and the being aware of your body and embodied in the space. And what the body needs, as mm-hmm. you said before,
mm-hmm.
Are these, it's a wonderful to have a book like Curb and a multimedia companion piece like Curbed, which is available on your website, to in some ways try to gather it together, certainly not contain it, but let's talk about Curb a little, and maybe maybe our family as our way in.
Yeah, that sounds great. You know, Kith happened before Curb, and the next book is called Kin. And I love imagining these three books being interrelated because they all start with the ik or the ka sound, which is the first letter, the first consonant in Tamil, and also the Devanagari. So in Hindi and in Tamil, you have the ka and the ik. So we have Kith, we have Curb, we have Kin. And I am interested in starting points or origins.
Yes.
And the family unit, both nuclear and extended, is a place of fascination for me because there is so much variety in it. It's such a kaleidoscopic entity that's always prone to slip and slide and change. It's so dynamic. And because I think in the United States, diasporic poets are constantly trying to understand how belonging works. I thought, you know, the family, however we imagine family, is a basic unit of kinship that I want to query and challenge and question. And it's because, you know, it's like, it's what Benedict Anderson says about imagined communities. It's not so much, you know, who you're willing to live for as who you're willing to die for. And that's also another way of thinking about nationhood and nationalism. So how we talk about the family in the United States is a kind of litmus for how we talk about nation, right? I mean, that's why some of the most defensive and conservative ideas we see parading now in the U.S. will masquerade as a concern about the family.
Family values.
Values. What is that code for now?
Yes.
And how can poetry undo that code, take it apart and say, actually, this is, I'm going to make it transparent for you
and redefine it
for you. Yeah. And that's why the family is so present in my work. And it's also because love is a, I was going to say it's a battlefield. I'm just kidding.
Get a little Pat Benatar later.
But it is. I mean, I think to fuse family and nation, love is a battlefield, right? I mean, that is another way of saying what Benedict Anderson is saying, is it is not so much who you live for, but who you are willing to die for. So Kith is a book, very much about the male members of my family who went on to become migrant laborers in different countries, whether that's, you know, in the UAE and the Gulf states where, you know, the labor laws are so horrific and don't protect migrant laborers from South Asia, whether it's someone like my dad who traveled and, you know, worked in places like Libya and Malaysia and Singapore, translating salt water into sweet water, which I think is just such a romantic occupation.
Yes.
And so that book was concerned about that side of my family. And Curb is very interested in the women of my family and the femmes of my family and mother-daughter relationships, you know, becoming a mother and also then suddenly becoming aware of my daughterliness in a new kind of alertness. Yeah.
And that's lovely. Connecting also to the family and this relationship of where we are in space, because here now you're in Michigan, and earlier you were also there. You spent some years after Buffalo in Singapore, so connecting with and being close and further away, I would imagine, to family, and then creating your own family through, like, the nuclear family, mm-hmm. as you said, with a partner who's a Michigander or so. What does that mean for you in working in and across spaces? Because coordinates, we were joking a little off air a few minutes ago about the coordinates that are present in Curb that are not a joke at all. You can place these poems mm-hmm. in, like, using the coordinates mm-hmm. that are at the top of the page. But how do you think that is sort of something, either the space and moving across the land and sea? And
yeah, I've been an immigrant since I was 11. And so I moved from India to Singapore when I was 11. I moved from Singapore to the United States when I was 18. And then I moved back to Singapore again in my 30s. And then I moved back to the United States. And I have family all over the world, in the United Kingdom, Australia, and so on. Right, so I have Welsh cousins and Irish cousins in the same way that I have, you know, Southern Indian cousins in, you know, Virginia. So, like,
that's a rich landscape of cousins.
It is a rich landscape. You know, weddings and Christmas dinners are a real joyful kind of escapade in accents. You know, like,
bring your own,
right? Bring your own BYOA. And so growing up, always I felt I was living by at least two clocks. So you'd wake up in the morning and say, oh, it's 8 a.m. Oh, the joy of waking up at 8. Now that as my parent, I'm like, that's never happening. But you'd wake up at 8 a.m. and think, what time is it in India? Or I'll travel back to India and say, well, what time is it in the US now? And just this
as a reflex.
As a reflex. It's a similar reflex to converting whatever currency I'm in now to the previous currency I was using. So, right, like, you know, how many rupees is this going to be? Or how many Singapore dollars is this going to be? And when I was a teenager, I just gave up and I just started counting everything by CD units. Like, how many CDs will this be? Or how many hamburgers? But I bring up the clocks to say, I always think I'm living by at least two clocks. And I've had to come to terms with there being a kind of discrepancy or a belatedness in how I arrive to things. I'm frequently late to events because I'm always recalibrating or, you know, resetting my clocks. The coordinates in my book, so which is spatial rather than temporal, I had a very specific reason for that. If anyone has the book, they'll see that there are two or three sets of geospatial coordinates at the right upper corner of almost every poem in Curb. And you can, when you dog ear the page, you are basically marking or paying attention to the coordinates where the poem is situated. And it's there because, first, I'm a really badly behaved reader of physical books. I love dog-earing them. I will use almost anything as a bookmark. Like, I have been known to use a pizza slice as a bookmark. And I thought, you know, I really like to get into it. Oh, yes, it's terrible. I like to have my books be really lived in.
Yes.
Like a familiar sweater, right? A happy pair of pants. So this dog-earing practice is a way of saying a body was here, it was reading this page, it needed to pause, it needs to return. And the physical act of reading, I wanted it to be really pronounced and for the reader to be aware that they were reading, not just like swallowing a bunch of poetry, but actually reading, deciphering signs, stopping, having to return. And that activity of reading needs to be pronounced because so many of my family members and people who are important to me, people in my community, they don't read in a way, they read in a naturalized way, right? In the sense that they come to English as a second language. Or they come to English as a third language. And so they have to read with a kind of attention, a real awareness of the physical action. Like, you'll see almost anyone who is studying English as a second language move a finger across a line slowly. That feeling and that sound of the finger across the page is so important. It's a gorgeous sound. And so what is the sound that the page makes when you fold it and then uncrease it? And over time, what happens to that crease? What do you lose of the book when it finally falls apart? So those were some of the considerations with these coordinates. But the
And you include these sounds, this the images or capturing it, articulating in language within Curb as well.
Within the book itself,
yes.
Yeah. Because, you know, I always want to be a reader when I'm being the speaker and the writer of the poem as well.
Because to have that to have that consciousness to understand what the experience you're creating is.
Yes. I mean, I think it's irresponsible to present myself as someone who makes meaning rather than someone who is trying to also interrogate it and request your presence as an interlocutor of that meaning. Because without the listener, I am nothing. Without a listener, I am just crying into the void. Right. So the poem is that relationship with the reader. And in order for me to have a good relationship, I have to, like in a human relationship, I have to lay my cards on the table. I have to say, this is where I'm coming from. I need to make myself somewhat transparent through my craft. But, you know, there's also opacities that are really, really important to all good relationships, boundaries and opacities, and saying, I reserve the right to withhold this from you. We are not ready to trespass upon this information. And that's a poem too for me, is that negotiation between opacity and transparency, what I'm willing to tell you and what you don't have the right to ask from me.
Yes.
And the second thing I wanted to say about coordinates, if we have a moment, it was very, very important to me and remains really important to me as a South Asian American writer that the violences against immigrants in this country, which is ongoing, and I expect is about to escalate even further very soon, those violences cannot and should not be abstracted in a poem. I did not want anyone to read a poem in my book and say, isn't it terrible how pitiable these immigrants are? They just keep getting attacked everywhere and all the time. They're such victims. It's actually, I wanted you to know about this one man who went for a drink after work, and this thing happened to him in this place. And this is a poem about that event. I do not want that violence to be a generalized framework through which my people and I am seen.
Thank you, Divya. Let's take a short break. We'll be back today on the program. Divya Victor is here. The book on the table with us, Curb. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
சொந்தமடி
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. Divya Victor is here in the studio. Her book, Curb, on the table with us. Before we went to break, we were talking about some of what is at the very... There's so much happening within the covers of Curb. And I think, and I only wish that I could see the art book that you created of Curb, where you are having to, it's laid out and you're walking around it. And there's these, seeing how this book is, the things, the pieces, how they flow into each other. There's disconnects, but there's always flow mm-hmm. as well. And how the pieces are meant to be together in this form, even though what we have sometimes is like, we have a book, which we're so lucky to have, the artifact of the book, not always having to read on screen. Mm-hmm. But what you're doing with this form, I love, because you're not just seeing what the boundaries are and putting like an individual poem on mm-hmm. a page or like a group of individual poems. There's something at work that's within. And even I feel like you can't stop in some way, because even as we started talking about Curb, you said, well, Kith came before Curb. Curb is next, and then there'll be mm-hmm. Kin. Like, you're seeing it within the breadth mm-hmm. of this larger movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But let's talk about Curb, because yeah. this, or if you want to say anything, I don't mean to.
No, yeah. I was enjoying the way you were describing it, because continuity is paramount for me. The idea and the impression that we are living a continuous life is life-saving, because there are so many ruptures that are going to interrupt it. So creating connectivity is really what storytelling is about. And I do see my work as a poet across books, and also within the book is the work of storytelling arc.
Yes, and so many different kinds, because it's yours, it's testimonials, it's conversations you had with people, it's mm-hmm. research, it's coordinates.
Yes, and that is what storytelling is. It's creating this tissue of connectivity between stories you overhear, the stories you inherit, the stories that are told mm-hmm. to you, the stories you're eavesdropping on, the mythologies you're creating for yourself. And from all of that, we come up with something we call our life story, right? And so Curb has stories from that are told to me by my kin and my friends, testimonials from courtrooms, which is a kind of storytelling. You know, it's storytelling, even though we have to swear an oath to truthfulness, mm-hmm. which, you know, some of the best stories do swear that oath, even if it's not explicit and it's not on a holy book. This contains stories in the sense that I am transcribing what is said to me in Uber rides, you know, given the long and fraught history of, you know, the taxi workers union in the United States, in which most of the members are South Asian. So many of the members are South Asian. So I receive those stories. I think of a poem as a womb for other people's stories, where something new can gestate and be born.
I love that. Can we hear some of Curb?
Yes, let's do that. And since I spoke about wombs and different kinds of nourishment and parenting and adoption that's taking place of other people's stories, I want to start with the very first poem on page one of Curb. I started writing this book right after Donald Trump took office for the first time. And it is, I cannot tell you the kinds of feeling I'm really having just a few days before the inauguration, still reading this book. And this first poem is almost, it is verbatim, a quotation from my mother in September of 2017. I was a new mother, she was a new grandmother, and we were just taking, you know, our daughter out in her pram, in her stroller around the neighborhood. And it's the neighborhood in which a lot of this book is located. You'll know this by the coordinates. And also, I hope everyone's nice listening so they don't track me down. And on this walk, I asked my mother, you know, how are you feeling, Mum, now that Trump's in office? How are you feeling about that? And she paused for a very long time. And then she said to me, and this is the poem, since you asked, yes, I am afraid all the time, all the paces are all the same to me. All of us are the same to all of them. This is all that matters. All of us don't matter at all. So what struck me then is that this is a sentence in which the word all repeats. And I think a lot about what that collective is and how impossible it is within any democracy, this notion of an all. It's such a moment of fracture, right? And to hear it as a sentence is this. Since you asked, yes, I'm afraid all the time. All the places are all the same to me. All of us are the same to all of them. This is all that matters. None of us don't matter at all. Or all of us don't matter at all. But when you translate it into a poem by introducing the line break, yes, then you're paying a new kind of attention to that collective. And so in Curb, it is really at the very edge of that poem, you see, I am all, I am all, I am all, I am all, I am all. And it's this overwhelming wish for a collective too. And there is a kind of second part to this poem, which is an attribution of the quote. My mother, this is a quote from my mother, as we pull my child in a radio flyer wagon painted cinnabar or hemoglobin, we are dragging all that blood around in the afternoon with the fear set soft in limbs roving the sidewalks or the land of the free and the home of the brave. And that last line leads into, which of course we all recognize here, leads into the second poem, which I want to read. And this poem is called Settlement. And I'd love to talk about how I wrote this poem after as well. Settlement. Settlers over the land, over the seas, over the tile, over the stone floors, settlers over the firs, over the pinewood planks of the house, settle the houses, settled into the ground, the houses so buried, settling, pulling life like splinters from the toboggans and caravans, pulling cargo, settled out of suitcases, settled down, we settled in, and so settled we into our ways, and with those ways did we settle for this empty of history, for this sternum rent in two, for this conscience as quiet as the snap of a wishbone sucked white.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening.
Thank you for reading it, because poems in the air, in your mouth, and then into the air and over the airwaves into others' ears, it is a different experience, mm-hmm, from reading it on the page. And first you said, you describe how in the first poem, the visual is an element that we also, you would get other layers of it, the eye wanting the all.
Yeah.
But, and the hearing it too is so beautiful. This, it's delivered in such a way that I feel remarkably new in the poem, even though I've read it a couple of times. So thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for asking me, because I too feel remarkably new in the poem. I learned from the poet Myung-mi Kim, who was my teacher, that a poem should remain unstable.
Yes! Say more.
Yes. And so performance is a way for you to become, again, not the poet, but the writer, right?
Right.
To return to the decisions of the composition, to play it again in your body, which is a different body now than it was when it composed, to validate it and to animate it with your breath is to say, I give you life the way you have given me life, right? This poem, you gave me life. Here I am back to you. And then to have listeners witness that life, right? That's really, we call it a performance,
But it's a witnessing.
But it's a witnessing. But it is a witnessing.
And how so? Why do you say that? Why is this a, like a belief and something you value clearly?
I think we listen each other into being. You know, when a baby cries and no one attends that cry, that baby does not know that it can acquire speech, right? The mother returns, the father returns, the parent returns, and so it goes, momo, right? Mama, dada, momo. And there is an acknowledgement. There is a symbol that is transpiring between them, an agreement reached. If I make this sound, a creature shows up that carries me. And I don't know that poets are so far from that infant. You know, we've just come up with some sophisticated approaches to the symbol, but we need someone to come into the room when we utter it.
Yes. And have you found that then when you come to this poem, have you read it different ways?
Sometimes,
that's what I'm thinking maybe is true.
Yeah, I do. I do read it in different ways. And there are several poems in Curb that are meant to be read in as many ways as you like, with as many voices. I often score my work for three or more voices in performance, too.
And so what would that look like then? Would you say, like, you would know to change it? Would you be giving all three of the voices?
No.
Or you would bring people on?
I would
on.
Bring people in. I travel, I'll just ask an MFA student to say, would you like to read this? And there are poems in here, which I won't read now, but maybe tomorrow night I will read a poem like Blood Soil, which is a polyvocal text. You know, and some poets think that all poems are polyvocal. I strongly disagree with that. Where the speaker is engaging with found language from dash cam footage from a police encounter. It's, you know, this poem contains language from Newton's laws of physics. So I think it's interesting and important for us to live with all the tonalities and the gradients and the grain of different voices speaking and to really take on the and enjoy the personas, right? I remember reading that poem, Blood Soil, which is about the apprehension, the illegal apprehension of an elderly immigrant Indian man in Alabama, Suresh Bhai Patel. I remember reading this poem with the poet Brandon Brown on the steps of a film set in Paramount Studios. So the performance was even more amplified because Brandon had to play the cop. And I was playing the speaker who's talking, you know, about this incident with an immigrant.
Yes.
And Brandon was so uncomfortable, naturally.
Yes.
Giving embodiment. And so we had a very interesting conversation about structural positionality and how performance amplifies some of those roles we end up taking on.
Yes. You seem always ready to see what the work can be, as I think... as you're finding it, but even as it is, like you said, returning to it.
Yeah, because the composition can never be done. You know, like you can close the file, you can save the file, and you can send it out into the world.
You
can send it out to your publishers because they'll make you.
Right.
But the poem can never be completed because then it dies. And I don't want it to die. I want to always live with it. And I wanted to be my teacher. Settlement, which I read, was written in Michigan at a family Thanksgiving. So part of my family is white, and they come from Dutch people, and I think they're fourth gen. And halfway through this fairly self-aware, you know, Thanksgiving, which was the last Thanksgiving I attended, Thanksgiving meal I attended, in this family that I love very much. When I said love is a battlefield earlier.
Okay.
Returning to that theme, it's a family I love deeply, and they're a part of me as I'm a part of them. I still had to leave the table, and I went to the bathroom and sat on the edge of the tub, and I just wrote this poem in its entirety on the phone. And then I reemerged. I said, this is how I will participate. I'll write my way through this dinner. And it became one of the first poems in Curb, because to reckon with the history of immigrants here, we have to, of course, reckon with the history of genocide and displacement of Native peoples in Michigan, for one.
Everywhere. Yes. And it seems like with Curb, too, we haven't really talked directly about the title, but we've talked around it in ways, like thinking about the spatial and something that drops off, and the edges or boundaries of something, and where you can be safe or not safe.
Mm-hmm. It's a verb and a noun.
Yes.
You can curb someone. You can curb an action, and it's an edge. It's just an edging device. And the book is very interested in how immigrants and the children of immigrants move through public spaces, particularly in the suburbs and in urban environments. So the curb is a defining line.
And even in this moment of family, there was a curb for you, and you had to step away to find some other part of who you are and know the world to be to then rejoin.
Yeah, and to sit on the edge of a tub.
Exactly.
Another kind of curb.
When you said that, that's what I pictured. So,
yeah, yes. And let me tell you, sitting on a hard surface with a soft spot will make you write a poem real fast.
Divya, what do you think about reading some of your essays?
Sure.
Would you like to do that?
Yeah.
Or is there something that you want to say about Curb that we haven't gotten to yet?
We can talk about the next book. Is that
okay.
What you mean?
Yes.
When you say,
that would be great.
Do one of your essays?
Yes.
How much time do we have, T?
We have about 8 minutes.
Ah.
I just looked over, just for everyone out there, looked over to Jason for approval. I can only see half of your face. Okay.
Well,
we're good.
You
got the thumbs
I don't know
up.
How much I can read from it, but let me tell you a little bit about the book that's coming up with Grey Wolf. I do have a portion picked out for all of you in case we have time. So this is a book of essays that's coming out with Grey Wolf in 2027. I'm in the process of writing it, and it is a book that tries to bring our collective attention to the curiosity and longing and intellectual excitement and erotic life and pleasures and joys of South Asian women in the diaspora across contemporary visual and plastic arts, film, and poetry. So, you know, there are essays about a history of orgasms. There are essays about how girls play within the diaspora, and how that can teach us certain ways of, you know, imagining revolutionary practice within our everyday lives. And I'm going to read a little bit, if we have time, from an essay about heap formations. So heaps, laundry heaps, trash heaps, which are just, you know, collections of objects that you have not really thought about, that are in a pile or a mound in a corner of your house that you're not paying attention to. And what I am fascinated about with heaps is that they are a gathering, but the minute you move one thing, one object from them, they fall apart. So they shift all the time. Mm. They're dynamic. They shapeshift, and they go under the radar. They're very much like a diaspora. And but I think the way they fall apart teaches me something about what we do with ourselves when we fall apart. And so it's a very long essay that considers what we can learn from heap-like shapes in contemporary art and poetry, and also daily living. So I'm going to read for a few minutes from a section in this essay that is about the kinds of heaps that would form when we undressed from saris after weddings. I think it'll be about 5 minutes long. So do we have that time, T?
Yes, we'll just be on the edge, okay. But I think we can
you
do it.
You send me a signal when I need to pause.
Okay.
The story goes like this. When the Tamil actress and politician Jayalalitha was a child, she slept wrapped in her mother's sari, while her mother was still wearing it. To leave her in the morning, her mother would have to unwind herself from her 6 yards, and another woman, a surrogate, would wind herself back into it. Stretched out, this fabric became an umbilical cord shared between many women and one child. In a heap, this fabric is a nest in progress, always somewhere between being made and unmade. I do not know if this story is true, but I know one that is. After weddings or Christmas Mass, the women in my family undress in the same room. We unspool the saris 6 yards from our bodies like we are emerging from a chrysalis. Named for chrusos, the Greek word for gold, which resembles the sheen of some pupae, the soft chrysalis of the sari ribbons off us and coils around our feet. We step out from the coil in velvet heels or with toes reddened with henna or with ashy ankles or with sharp bunions or in silver anklets, and the coil softens cautiously like a cobra digesting. Silk moths spit and spin a cocoon to prepare for their complete metamorphoses, building, like snails and turtles, mussels and oysters, temporary shelters for their becoming. Undressing is an address. It names the place where we live. Undressing is also another form of address, a kind of speech. Those you choose to undress near become the addressees of a body revealing itself in a flash of time between unmaking and making. An auntie comes by and gathers the coils of saris and piles them. She places jute ochres on jeweled silks and delicate pastels until a heap forms at the center of the room. We've returned from a coastal wedding and the silk has drawn the cathedral's walls to itself. The fragrance of the heap is lavish with marigolds from wedding garlands, the acrid brine of rock salt, beeswax and smoke, frankincense, rosewater. Because of sweet talc or the salt of her sweat, I can tell apart my mother's coil in any heap of saris. With my eyes closed, I can tell her apart. I have been raised inside the curves and folds of such heaps, inside a form warmed by the body, creased by teak pews and cooled by terrazzo floors. When we undress, the slow ancient ceiling fan sulks and sputters, casting feathered shadows on the golds, browns, and deep sables of my family's women. I stare at their long breasts, the soft folds of their bellies, the whisper of hair in their dusky armpits. I read the contour lines of their stretch marks and surgery scars as a cartography of births and near deaths, an index of organs removed or altered. These lines are the evidence of gravity's great work in holding each generation to this earth. In disrobing, we are addressed and read like this. We have a correspondence to each. We are made kin.
Thank you. What was it like to read that?
Oh my God, it was so... it's the first time, certainly in the United States, that anyone's heard that.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Divya.
It's a pleasure, T. Thank you for asking me.
It was beautiful. I loved it. And how there's this connection where you said this heap is connecting to us to the earth. And that's like the final moments of mm-hmm. Curb as well.
Which is the feet on the ground.
Yes.
Yes. And, Oh, we're wrapping.
Do you want to say the last line, Divya?
The last line? It's time to wrap?
Yes, I think so.
In honor of feet on the ground, wherever we may go?
Yes, it's on a scrap tied to a place which holds your feet to the ground. Thank you so much today, Divya Victor, here in the studio. Her book, Curb, the book to come, will be kin, coming in 2027 from Grey Wolf, tomorrow at UMA, on Friday at Robert Hayden Room at 10 a.m. I'm T. Hetzel. You've been listening to Living Writers, and I'm so glad you did. Thanks for joining us, everyone out there. Until next time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, T. Oh,
mohabbat. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Live from Ann Arbor, welcome back to the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihan Iswar, and I'm joined by Evan and Kayali. Hope all of you are staying safe from this polar vortex and these brutal Ann Arbor winter conditions. How are you two doing? Good to have you on.
I'm good. It's good to be here.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little under the weather, but, you know, I rallied. I made it here.
We're glad you were able to make it, Vihan.
Glad to have you.
Yeah, I'm glad I was able to make it. As always, we'll get the ball rolling with just a light, fun icebreaker question. Obviously, we're back on campus, which means, you know, house parties and bars are starting to get back into swing. And that means a lot of 2010s pop music. So I want to know, what's everyone's favorite 2000s, 2010s throwback pop song? Don't need to pick your absolute favorite. You can just pick one if you enjoy it, because obviously
that's a hard question.
That is a hard question. I'm going to go with Rocketeer by Far East Movement. I think that's just been one of my favorite songs, and it's pretty fitting for the career path I ended up on.
I'm going to have to go with, I think, Fireball by Pitbull.